Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service of public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on debt when we come back. Hey, if you're earning $50,000 a year, and if you pay all of your 14 taxes, then you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. The government gets the other 60%. That's right, 60% for the government, 40% for you. That's $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you go out and work twice as hard, produce twice as much, and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you're going to net about 25%, and the government gets 75%. That means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more. You're going to net about 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year by producing twice as much. And that's guaranteed by Congress and the IRS. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package? And let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we're paying so much and receiving so little. And let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Now, to order your free general law CD package, just call us direct at 417-273-4967. That number again, 417-273-4967, or you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about debt. I pointed out to you last time that even the wealthy people can't make ends meet. Michael Jackson, he can't manage his money. And Madonna, spending $1 million a month on her household expenses. Larry Flint wrote me a check bounced, making $12 million a month. So the President of the United States, nice guy that he is, and all those congressmen and representatives, all well-meaning people, every single one of them, but there's many of them there that can manage money, as evidenced by the fact that they're running the country into debt, running the country at a deficit every year, unable to manage the national debt, unable to manage the national income and outgo. And we keep electing them to office, you know, every election, keep sending them back, which demonstrates to me that the American electorate is insane. Insane, because they expect a different outcome, but they keep performing the same act every election. And that's the definition of insanity, as I understand it. It's the guy that does the same thing over and over again and expects a different result. That's not very sane. That's not very rational. Now, if you're in debt, you're in debt because you put yourself into debt. Nobody did it to you. Now, somebody's going to say, like, I had a guy one time, he stole $40,000 out of the company and put me into a god-awful debt. Hell, I did that to myself. Gave him the keys to the store. You know, there's a thing called business. We go to college, and we go to college so that we can learn a profession so that we can make more money. I would suggest that we go to college and change the curriculum from making money to managing money, because the average Mexican coming up here from Mexico working for $5 an hour, he's not unable to make ends meet. He pays his bills, pays his rent, pays his expenses, and sends money home. And I don't know if those people have college degrees or not, but I would suspect that the average Mexican who is here in this country illegally is probably not a college graduate. In all probability, he did not go to college. Doesn't have an MBA. Doesn't have a degree after his name. But the guy's able to work. He's able to save money. He's able to pay his bills. He pays his way in life. Well, that's more than most Americans can do, because the average American, I reported to you the other day, is $84,000 in debt, and that's just on his consumer debt. Then he's got a mortgage on his house, and then he's got a car debt. And there's a seductive lure to this luxury. It's being marketed to us. It's being sold to us, and we're buying it. Well, hell, you know, if you're out here buying it, well, don't complain about it. Nobody's forcing this on you now. Now, this law, we were talking the last time here about Parkinson's Law, which posits that work expands to fill the time available for its completion. And he made another observation on Parkinson's law. He says, household spending expands to consume rising income. If you get a raise next month, you're going to spend it. You're going to have a dilemma. How am I going to get rid of this money? You're not going to save it. You're not going to invest it. You're not going to do anything with it. You're going to go out and spend it. You're going to buy a bigger, better house, a bigger, better car, or something like that. This law explains why so many people who make a very comfortable living with steadily rising income can't seem to accumulate any wealth. They're always vowing to start saving some real money someday as soon as their incomes rise a little bit more. But their problem, of course, isn't how much they earn, but it's how much they spend. And their overspending is likely rooted in an inability to distinguish between needs and wants. Needs and wants. I reported to you a little earlier. No, the average guy, he's not concerned about food, clothing, and shelter, at least not in the United States. He's concerned about satellite TV, newer, bigger, better cars, clothes washers and clothes dryers and home air conditioning, microwaves and TV sets and car air conditioning and home computers and cell phones and dishwashers and cable and satellite TV and high-speed internet and flat-screen TVs and iPods. And these are the things that Americans consider necessities. Did you get that? You know, there's people, you go out and you poll them and say, your iPod, whatever the hell an iPod is, I don't even know what the hell you do with one. But whatever this iPod is, Americans believe that it's a necessity. Well, I don't think it's a necessity. I don't even know what it is. Flat screen TV. I've got a TV upstairs. The screen is flat. As far as I can tell, I mean, it's got a little bit of curve to it, but, you know, by and large, it's pretty flat. But evidently, there's something out there called a flat screen TV. I guess that's the opposite to a round screen TV. I don't know what a flat screen TV is. And somebody uses words and things like DSL and high speed internet. And what's that? You know, to us old farts out here, we don't even know what the hell half these things are. And they're called necessities. I didn't know that. I don't even know how to spell it, for crying out loud. So us old guys, we didn't know that those were necessities. I'll tell you what I think is a necessity. Food, clothing, and shelter. I think that the loss of our bees now to genetic modification of crops, which is destroying their immune systems and killing them, is a hell of a lot more of a necessity. I think that a colony of bees, kids, is a hell of a lot more necessary to our subsistence and survival than car air conditioning, home computers, or cell phones. I think that one's going to come home to roost. I mean, I'm not here to tell you how to live your lives, but, you know, people that can't pay their bills and are filing for bankruptcy over here are failures in life because they can't manage money. They go to college and learn how to make money, but then they can't manage it after they've made it. I need and I want. The blurring of this needs-wants distinction helps fuel our consumer society. After all, the whole point of marketing is to convince you, the consumer, that things that you once considered to be optional luxuries are now typical necessities of the good life. You've got to have this. You need an iPod. I don't know what it is, where you get it, or what you do with it after you get it, but by God, you need one. Well, if I was an iPod salesman, I'd be out there trying to figure out some way to educate you as to what it is, what it does, how good it is, how it's going to make you feel better about yourself, and how you can afford one of these, and how you need to get one, whatever it is. Now, the success of this process over the last 20 years has resulted in what I call the democratization of luxury. Today, as never before, American households at virtually every income level seek products whose price, quality, and prestige clearly exceed the functional need to be met. Rising personal income, especially in highly educated dual-income households, made this splurging possible. But much of it isn't truly affordable because it's being financed by a surging tide of consumer debt, and it's crowding out saving for future needs, especially retirement. Okay, here's some examples. The production of luxury cars keeps soaring, thanks in part to easy financing with short-term leases. The 27-inch color TV is being replaced by elaborate home theaters with giant flat screens and throbbing sound. Middle-class preteens get their nails done professionally. Let me read that one again. What was that? Middle-class preteens. My God, middle-class 10-year-old girls are getting their nails done professionally. You mean you got your 10-year-old daughter in the beauty parlor having her nails done? Well, okay, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success, but as I've said, I think that the loss of our honeybees is going to come back and bite us in the butt. I think that you're going to wish that you had that money that you were spending on that nail job for your 10-year-old girl in the form of pinto beans in your pantry. I think that would make more sense. High school kids are ferried in rented stretch limousines to proms held in hotel ballrooms. Elegant plumbing fixtures, granite and marble kitchen counters, and oriental rugs are on display at the home and hardware superstores. Now, a generation ago, before luxury went mass market, many solidly middle-class consumers prided themselves on living simply. They knew the difference between needs and wants, and they were proud that their savings were quietly growing and that their increasing net worth wasn't evident to all the world. And not surprisingly, Americans' personal savings rate was a lot higher a generation ago than the historic lows of recent years. By holding fast to these values, many Americans accumulated surprising levels of wealth. They are the people described in The Millionaire Next Door, the eye-opening book by Thomas Stanley and William Danko that was published back in 1996. As these marketing professors demonstrate, conspicuous consumption may denote a high level of income, but it's rarely a reliable indicator of net worth. Let me read that one to you again, kids. Listen to this. Your conspicuous consumption may well denote your high level of income, but that very rarely is a reliable indicator of your net worth. Pay yourself first. Now, I know that everyone has a soft spot for certain indulgences, and I don't begrudge anyone his or her personal passion. The trick is to be selective in your luxury buying without abandoning your savings plan. If you're one of those people who say they never have anything left over after paying their bills, try the time-honored technique of paying yourself first. Make that first check you write each month a deposit into your investment account. Better yet, set up an automatic payroll deduction plan with your employer and a mutual fund. If you come up short after trying to pay all of your bills, you'll know what needs to be trimmed. Some of those wants that you redefined as needs. Hey, that's exactly correct. Now, let me tell you a little story here. I tell a story on myself every once in a while. I used to have some credit cards, and I was a credit card junkie. I had 28 of them, 28 credit cards. They just kept sending them to me, so I thought, ah, shucks. Little Georgie Gordon over here must be a very valuable customer to Arco and Shell Oil and all the MasterCard and Visa and all these guys. And so I went out, and over time, I maxed all these cards up. And one day, I had $12,000 worth of debt, and I couldn't service the debt. And I was a businessman. Listen, at the time this happened, I was producing $100,000 a month, employing 30 people, producing $100,000 a month, $1 million a year. I was paying $200,000 a year in taxes. I was making $100,000 a year. I was making a payroll of $10,000 a week. I had 28 credit cards. I maxed them out, had $12,000 worth of consumer debt, and I couldn't pay the debt. And I woke up one day and I said, how in the hell can this be? Now, it's true. I'm just a crummy high school dropout. But I looked at myself and I said, I can't believe that I've done this. I'm not managing my money correctly. I'm a bad manager of money. I can't handle credit cards. A little later on, I found out I was a practicing communist. But the first indication that my fiscal irresponsibility was out of control was when I maxed out those cards. So I went ahead and I paid it off. I mean, I paid off the whole 12 grand. I took the damn credit cards and I cut them up and I sent them back. And as I paid these credit card guys off, at first I wrote them a letter and I said, I'm upside down, can't pay you. So here's the plan I'm proposing. They all sent back and said, well, yeah, we'll go along with that. And then as I paid them off, they'd send me a new credit card. I said, you know, these guys are either insane, number one, or number two, they've got some ulterior motive behind this. Why would you send another credit card to some guy that's an admitted spendaholic that can't manage his finances? You know, if I came to you and I said, listen, I can't manage money, And I can't handle my credit cards, so you give me your credit cards and let me manage your money for you. And you know, these people had to be insane to give me a credit card, for crying out loud. I already demonstrated I couldn't handle it. It's like giving a heroin addict, you know, a little pile of heroin. Here, take care of this heroin for me, would you? You know, save it for me. Take care of it. Now, I don't know, kids. Yeah, I'm going to tell you there's an ulterior motive. The motive here is to put America into debt so that we can control you. That's what debt's all about. It's control. Now, if you want to be controlled by somebody, you know, you need more debt. If a little bit of control is good, can you imagine how much better a lot of control is going to be over you? If a little bit of debt's good, a whole lot of debt's got to be better. Or the opposite comes into view, that if debt's bad for you, then any debt's bad. Now, my conclusion is that debt's bad for you. And the credit card industry says, no, debt's good for you. Here's some more, and we'll send you another card. Let me bury you a little bit deeper in debt. Now they've come into the Congress and they said, well, now you can't bankrupt out of this credit card debt. It's kind of like your student loans. You know, you can get into debt, but you can't bankrupt out of it. What's that all about? You know, even God himself gives us a year of release once every 7 years. Bankruptcy is a counterfeit of the year of release. Now that you bought into the paper money, good life, credit debt usury, bond servitude program, now they closed the window. Now you can't get out of it. They locked you in. Now, I mentioned to you the other day, I said, now there's a way to get out of debt. There's a way to accumulate wealth, and the way to get out of debt is don't create it. Now, when I had credit cards in my pocket and I walked into the hardware store, I'd have $50 in my pocket, and I went to the hardware store because I needed a set of spark plugs and a set of plug wires. And I'm going to spend about $20, and I got $60. But when I got into the hardware store, I walked around a little bit, and I said, oh, geez, I need a battery, and so I pick up the battery. Oh, God, I got to have these jumper cables over here, so I pick up the jumper cables. Oh, look at this over here. I got to have that and a battery charger. And then pretty soon, the bill is $74. Now, I got $60 in my pocket, and I got $74 worth of stuff. So I'm $14 over budget. Do I put $14 back? No. Nobody with a credit card in his pocket ever put $14 back so that he could balance his available cash with his spending desires. He says to himself, shucks, I got credit cards in my pocket. I'll just make up the difference on a credit card. So now you go up to check out. You got $74 worth of stuff. You got $60 worth of cash, and you whip out your credit card, and she whips it up and says it's $74. Well, now you've got a choice. Do you give her $60 and then the credit card for $14, or do you give her the credit card for the whole $74 so you can keep some cash in your pocket because you got to meet Don down at Winchell's, and you got to have money for coffee and donuts, and you know, shucks, you might have to fill the gas tank. And so you give her the credit card, and you put the whole $74 on the credit card. Well, kids, it doesn't take you too long after a while of that kind of mismanagement, and your card's maxed out. Then you got to use a second card, and a third card, and a fourth, and there's no shortage. They keep sending you more cards, and they keep upping the limits, and that's to bury you in debt. Because, hey, listen, as long as you're working at General Motors, we haven't got a problem, because we'll just come over and put a lien on your paycheck. We'll come over and take ours first, and they know that. And they know that if they bury you in debt based upon your vanity, it's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. And you can rest assured, kids, if you can't manage your five basic motivators of human nature, somebody else is going to manage them for you. And they're going to manage those motivators to their best advantage. Now, I'm not telling you to get rid of your credit cards. I don't know. Hell, maybe you can manage your credit cards. I'm just telling you that little Georgie Gordon can't manage credit cards. I don't have any credit cards, and I'm not going to get any credit cards. And God love them, they send me offers every day in the mail. I don't even have a crummy social security number, and they're sending me credit card offers in the mail. I ought to fill one out in one of these days and see if they give me a credit card without a social security number. Well, anyway, that's that story. Now listen, you know, prices are going up. Have you noticed this? Listen to this. $1.99, that's the price of a gallon of 1% milk at Fred Meyer. That's a big box chain store in Seattle. That's $1.99, price of a gallon of 1% milk. $5.69 for a gallon of organic 1% milk at the Whole Foods store in Seattle. You got that? That's $3 more, you know, from 2 to 6, $4 more. It's $4 more money. Yeah. $1.99 is 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 5.69. $3 and some change more for a gallon of milk down here at the Whole Foods store. $4.29, that's the price of a Big Mac extra value meal at a Seattle McDonald's. Big Mac, medium fries, medium soft drink. $4.29. But it's $3.65. $3.65 is the price of a Vinny. That's a large latte with organic milk at a Seattle Starbucks. I mean, you could buy your Big Mac meal here for $4, but it costs you nearly the same price, $3.65, just for the Starbucks. 38.7, that's the average percentage of income that American households and the lowest 20% of income earners spend on food in 2003. So if you're down here in the lowest income level, you're spending about 40%. Of what you make on food. Hey, get this, 7.1%, that's the average percentage of income that American households and the highest 20% of income earners spent on food in 2003. Now, they spent $9,000 on food. That's in the high income bracket. Three times as much as the guy that's making, you know, he's in the lowest 20% income earners. But get this, while he's spending 7% of his income on food, the poor guy is spending 40%. Those are some pretty telling numbers there. Now, my wife, you know, she's a pretty handy lady, and again, without a college degree and hasn't been to home economics and one thing in school, but we were chit-chatting the other day, and she put a meal on, and it was macaroni and tuna fish, and it's summertime, and it's hot, and so we have some cold dishes, and just for the funsies of it, I said, sweetheart, what does this dinner cost? What does this lunch cost us? And she said, about 25 cents per serving. And I said, well, now, is this a balanced meal? And she said, yes, it's got protein, carbohydrates, it's got dairy. It's got the vegetables. She put in celery and cucumbers, and she put in tomatoes, and she put in mayonnaise, and she put in macaroni, and she put in tuna fish, and it's a tuna salad, and it costs 25 cents a serving. And I said, well, now that sounds pretty cheap to me. And she said, it is. It's pretty cheap. Now we have to make it here, and I can feed a family of four. That's how many is in our family. We can feed a family of four here on about $10 a day. You got that, boys and girls? My wife can feed a family of four on $10 a day. Hell, when I go to a restaurant, kids, the other day we went out to eat, and we went to Hemingway's in Springfield, and the bill was $46, and that's just for my wife and myself, two of us. Went into Hemingway's, sat down, ate good, I don't deny it. Well, I splurged, and we had $46, and we had dinner. Now, that's $23 each, includes dessert and all the good stuff that goes with it, coffee and so on. And my wife could have fed our whole family of four on that same $46, you know, for 4 days. You know, just putting her mind to it. Now, there's something to be said about pinto beans. Now, you know, we eat beans. You know, most people, you know, if you said, well, do you eat beans? Ugh. Well, we wouldn't eat beans. Well, okay. I guess you'd eat a McDonald's value meal, but you probably wouldn't eat beans. Now, my old granny, I don't ever recall, she told me one time, she said, I always have a pot of beans on the stove, pot of beans, big ham hock sticking in it. And, you know, you could sit down and eat other things, you know, but there was always a staple, you know, that you had for any time you came in, you were hungry, it could be lunch, it could be dinner, and there was always a pot of beans. And she made beans once or twice a week, a big pot of beans, I mean, great big kettle, you know. So, you know, a pot of beans, you know, you can get a serving or two of beans out of there, and that's pretty filling. And here's what's even more important. It balances your amino acids, and it balances your protein and carbohydrates. I mean, it's a balanced meal, healthful and nutritious. And there was an old guy in the Bible by the name of Daniel. And they took him into the king's palace one day, and they said, hey, we're gonna feed you here with lobster and pheasant under glass and one thing and another. And this Daniel, he took a look at this king's diet, and he said, nah, just give us the peelings and the lentils over here, and we'll just do real good. And so here's Daniel eating lentils and beans and peas and carrots and eating the cheap food over here, and he's actually getting by a little better than the average. Now, we Americans have a very high incidence of cardiovascular disease and cancer, higher than anybody else in the world. Do you ever wonder why? Do you ever think about the American diet? And then everybody says, my God, we've got to have health insurance. Health insurance. I don't have any health insurance. The last time I looked, it was $10,000 a year. $10,000 a year for a family of four for health insurance. I save $10,000 a year by eating pinto beans, kids. Now, I don't have cardiovascular disease. I did have cardiovascular disease, and I said, I got to get rid of that, and I did. You can get rid of your cardiovascular disease. You can get rid of your cancer. You can get rid of that expensive $10,000 a year that you're spending on health insurance. Let me tell you this. If you're going to eat pig and fat, you need health insurance. If you're going to eat fat and pig, if you're going to eat at McDonald's, you've got to spend that $10,000 a year on health insurance. Now, if you want to clean up your diet and eat that biblical diet that you see in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, what the hell do you need insurance for? What's that all about? Bottom line is, you know, insurance is a luxury that people that eat poor need to pay those hospital bills, which they're inevitably going to contract because of their bad diets, bad eating. Now, I think good health is cheap, and that's why I've got so much of it. Now, I'm pushing 70, kids, and I don't wear glasses, don't have a hearing aid. And when I finish this program, I'm going to get up and go to work. I'm going to quit this play, and I'm going to go out here and do something intelligent. And I'm going to be out here working, and I'm going to work up a sweat. You know, I don't need any exercise equipment, kids. When I go out here and put in a day's work, when I get through at the end of the day, you know, I don't need to run 5 miles. Now, maybe you do, but I don't. And, you know, your lifestyle over here can go a long ways to getting you out of debt, or better yet, keeping you out of debt. Now, most of you are already in debt, and so before we finish this program, you know, before we finish this series, I'm going to show you how to get out of debt and how to stay out of debt. Now, number one, I showed you today, get rid of the credit cards. If you've got credit card debt and you're making payments on your credit card, you cannot manage your debt and your credit cards any better than I could. And the ultimate end of that is you're going to max them out, and then you're going to be in a worse pickle than you're in already. And shucks, if you've got your credit cards maxed out, you know, you can't bankrupt out of them, but you can take those credit cards and you can send them back, and you can take that credit card debt and tell the credit card company to stick it where there's no daylight. Did you know that? There's a way to do that if you knew how. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. And we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet, daily. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. We're open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults, no kids, just adults, on computer or compact disc. Computer or compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order one, call the law school and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about debt. Mainly, we want to get out of debt. More importantly, I not only want to get out of debt, I want to make money, and lots of it. You know, I kind of get a kick out of making money. It's the way we businessmen keep score. It's not how many Rolex watches we run around with. I mentioned that to you last time. I've got a Rolex watch. I never wear it. It's too ostentatious, number one. Doesn't keep any better time than a $25 or $30 Timex, for crying out loud. Cost $1,000 or $2,000. I forgot how much it cost. They're really expensive. Rolex, it's kind of the Cadillac of watches, you know. And you're a nobody unless you've got a Rolex. And I suppose everybody in corporate America is running around wearing his Rolex. I just have my crummy Timex. I think them Timex watches are the greatest thing since sliced white bread. Well, the greatest thing since the old dollar pocket watches. Now, when we took our break here, I was giving you some wallet and grimace. I'm giving you some shocks here. Did you know that you're spending $8,759, you know, just for practical purposes, $9,000. That's the average annual cost of owning and operating a mid-sized car in the United States. We're not talking about a Ford Explorer. Now, just a mid-sized car, just an average, everyday garden variety car in the United States, assuming you're driving 15,000 miles a year, $9,000. The estimated annual cost of riding public transit at $1.25 a ride is $590. All right, let's think about this for a second, because, you know, most of you people live in the city. I mean, let's just be intelligent. You know, I'm out here in the country. If anybody has an argument for an automobile, it would be me, because I live out here in the country. But, you know, even living out here in the country, we can live without automobiles. Kids, the Amish people don't have cars. And I want to tell you that the Amish people are the only people in America that can go to a farm sale and bid $450,000 for a farm and then walk up to the auctioneer, open an attaché case, and pay for it in $100 bills. Now, how in the hell can these crummy Amish people who don't even have cars buy farms for $500,000 and pay cash? How do they do that? Boys and girls, the Amish people don't go to college. I don't believe there's an Amish person in America with a college degree. But there's not an Amish man in America that can't manage money. You won't find any Amish men in debt. Well, I don't know that many Amish. I guess I shouldn't be saying you won't find any Amish in debt, but I think you're going to find that it's pretty rare to find one in debt. Now, you got these illegal Mexican aliens up here sending $60 billion a year back home. Now, how in the hell can they do that on $5 an hour minimum wage? You can take a Vietnamese boat person, comes to the United States. He doesn't even speak the language. He's got a restaurant today. He's living the life of Riley. He's not having any problems. Is it because they've got better education in Vietnam? Or they're smarter people down in Mexico? Down in Mexico, or that the Amish people that don't even have automobiles, for crying out loud, and don't have college degrees, are smarter than you people with your MBAs and all of your degrees after your names, and $84,000 worth of consumer debt, spending $9,000 a year on the average cost of owning a mid-sized automobile. Now listen, I've got a car, and I don't begrudge anybody having a car, but I own mine. I'm not making any car payments. I own my car, and I think you ought to own yours. And if you're spending $9,000 a year, now I don't know how much we spend on our car here. I never have computed it out, to be honest with you. I don't know if I drive 15,000 miles a year or not. Hell, I might drive 30,000 miles a year for all I know. And the price of gasoline is going to $4 a gallon, and I'm not complaining about $4 a gallon gas. They're paying $6.38 a gallon in Holland. They pay nearly $6 a gallon in Britain, $5.50 in Germany. You know, those European people over there, their money is worth more than ours. They're managing their governments and economies better than we are here in America. They're paying more money for gasoline than we do here in the States. Hell, gasoline in Japan, I think, is $5 or $6 a gallon. Now, if those people can live and make a living managing their money, how come we can't? And that's my point. We can, and we could, if we wanted to, and if we would. And if you want to, I'm going to show you how to do that. I can manage my money. The Amish can manage their money. The illegal Mexican can manage his money. And these people don't have college degrees. Now, you got a college degree. Surely you must be smarter than the average Mexican wetback who's here in this country illegally working for minimum wage, wouldn't you think? I find this hard to believe that you doctors and dentists and real estate brokers and truck drivers in America, you know, making $50, $60, $70, $80,000 a year aren't as smart as, not as skilled and talented as, an illiterate Mexican. I find that hard to believe. It's true, but it's hard to believe. All right, so there's the grist. Now, this is an article that comes from www.grist.org. That's spelled G-R-I-S-T. Kind of a revealing little article. It's entitled Wallet and Grimace. And it gives you the numbers here. It tells you, you know, the percentage of U.S. children from poor families that had been diagnosed with asthma in 2002, 16%.
$618 a year, the average annual cost of all medical expenses for a child without asthma. $1,042, the average annual cost of all medical expenses for a child with asthma. Do you know that it costs you about twice as much when you got a kid with asthma? Why don't you get rid of the asthma? Do you know what causes asthma? Do you want to keep your asthma? Is it a status symbol that makes you feel real good? And you say to yourself, well, shucks, you know, my kid's got asthma, and I take him to the pediatrician every week. Costs me about $1,200 a year. And it's a status symbol. And we want to keep our kid with asthma and ADHD. Want to get rid of your ADHD? Take your kid off sugar. I know, it's a wild new concept. You want to get rid of ADHD? Take the little stinker off of sugar and it'll go away. Want to get rid of the asthma? Drink more water. It's just that simple. Now, of course, you can't take my word for that. Make sure you go to your pediatrician and get your paid professional advice. Hell, if the doctors knew what caused asthma, seems like to me we'd have a whole lot less of it. So if your kid's got asthma and the doctor can't cure it, sounds like to me the doctor don't know what causes asthma and doesn't know how to cure it. No, I don't think you have to be real smart to figure that out. We didn't have asthma in this country 50 or 75 years ago. Damn little of it. Didn't have ADHD. Never heard the term attention deficit disorder. I don't know what the hell that is. Now, I don't know, they got millions of kids today that are on drugs, you know. It's great for the drug companies. I don't begrudge the drug companies selling drugs to people that are foolish enough to buy them and kids that are sick enough to use it. And if that's what you want to buy, spend your money on, hey, get after it. And it seems like to me that good health is better than bad health, and that good health is cheaper, and good health is better and more profitable. Costs less. Good health costs less than sickness. Now, we got a thing here called affluenza. I like that term. Affluenza. The All-Consuming Epidemic by John DeGraff, David Wan, and Thomas H. Naylor, published by Barrett Kohler Publishers. And this is a little piece that pulled off the web. www.swaraj. Now, that's a hard one. Write it down. www.swaraj.org. Affluenza. It's the few illusions have riveted the imagination of urban India so overwhelmingly as the myth of the American dream, with its emphasis on high consumption, compulsive acquisition, and instantaneous gratification. A corollary of this illusion seems to be that the only way to accomplish it is through an information technology and biotechnology-driven economy. The new elites of the knowledge-based economy, with their sumptuous salaries and fast and fun-filled lives, are the exemplars of the consumerist nirvana that the vast rural hinterlands of India yearn to attain. Even if one concedes that illusions are the stuff of life, the deceptive notion that happiness consists of possessing things, regardless of the price one has to pay, needs to be subverted. In other words, it's a crock of BS. I'm going to put a bracket around that. There was an old guy by the name of Solomon. Now, Solomon was the richest man in the world of his day. He was the Bill Gates of his time. Solomon had a lot of wives, too. I think he had, 300 wives and 700 concubines, or 700 concubines and 300 wives. I kind of forget, but it was 1,000 women. I mean, this is the American dream. Well, you know, kind of. Here in the Ozarks, the American dream is total disability on Social Security. That's number one. Sex is somewhere down the line, 2, 3, 5, or 9. But the average Joe six-pack American, he's thinking about sex all the time. He wants to bed down Madonna and 5 other of these celebrities like Britney Spears and a couple others like that. And then, of course, he's got to have a Rolex watch and a Corvette to drive around in. And the purpose isn't that this Corvette is necessary and imperative to his business or his job or something like that. It's a status symbol that he wants to drive around in so that he can make a statement to everybody. I drive a Corvette. What do you drive? I drive a GMC. I remember old Frank Roach, who drove a GMC. It was a 49 GMC pickup, and the back fenders were all rusted out. And as he drove down the road, those back fenders would flop back and forth. It was pretty funny. It was like Dumbo trying to fly. It was Frank Roach's GMC pickup trying to fly is what it was. And those fenders, they just flop back and forth. I don't think Frank ever drove over 35. If he'd have drove 50, hell, those fenders would have flew off at 50. But at 35, they just flopped back and forth. Made a little noise. And why was it? Well, the cow manure, you know, driving up down the lane gets up underneath there, and it's full of acid and rusts them out pretty fast. That's what the big problem is. But old Frank, you know, he got along on that pickup pretty well. He wasn't the status symbol kind of guy, but he was a money man. And in 1955, he had more than $1 million. Not bad for an immigrant who came to this country with $5 in his pocket in 1922. By 1955, he had $1 million. And isn't 55 million bucks was a lot of bread, like 10 million today. And I mentioned this the other day to you. I said, now, how does a crummy immigrant that can't even read, write, and spell, never spent a day in school, never had a pair of shoes until he was 17, come to America with $5 in his pocket, and in 30 years or so, he ends up with in today's dollars, $10 million. How does he do that? The answer is no debt. No debt. No debt. People that make money have money and accumulate money have no debt. If you're in debt, you can kiss money goodbye. you don't know how to manage money if you're in debt. Now, when I was in debt, I didn't have any money either. And I should have been listening to old-timers like Frank and Lindy LaFranchi and Walter Bugnuda, you know, some of those old-timey guys. But I didn't. You know, I was a punk kid with pimples on my face, and I was smarter than they were because I went to school. Now, here's one thing I've learned. The people with the best educations aren't necessarily the people that have the most money. Now, listen to these numbers here. Paying for everyday living purchases. When you go out to buy something, how do you pay for it? Do you pay for it with cash, check, debit card, or credit? Think about this again. Do you pay for it with cash, check, your debit card, or credit card? Or do you use some other form of credit, not just a credit card? Debit includes debit cards and credit cards. Well, listen to this. All adults, if you're an adult and you're one of them, 37% use cash, 15% pay with check, 31% use credit or debit cards, and 16% use credit, revolving credit at the store. All right, now, if you take a look at gender, like men or women, you take a look at race and ethnicity, you take a look at age, education, and family income, and your income may be less than $30,000 a year or more than $100,000. Well, get this. If you're using cash, that is $20 bills out of your wallet, you're on a cash basis, you're a rare duck. You're not in the majority. In fact, the better educated you are, the less likely that you're using cash. And if you're a woman, you're more likely to be using credit than cash. If you're white, you're more likely to be using credit than cash. And if you're between 30 and 64 and you're white and a woman, you're more likely to be using credit than cash. If you're a college graduate, ladies, you're more likely to be using credit than cash. And if you're making $100,000 a year, you're more likely to be using credit rather than cash. Now, remember, the Mexican who came across the border illegally and is in this country as a criminal, making $5 an hour, is sending $60 billion a year back to Mexico. He's using cash. You people that are making $100,000 a year as a real estate broker, a lawyer, a dentist, or a doctor, you people are using credit. You're in debt up over your eyeballs. You ain't sending money to Mexico or any place else. You can't even pay your own bills, and you're contemplating suicide or bankruptcy. So, if you're a woman, white, between 30 and 64, a college graduate making $100,000 a year, you're in that 19% bracket that use cash and 81% bracket that uses some other form of credit. However, if you're a man, Hispanic, 18 to 29, a high school dropout making less than $30,000 a year, then you're in that 54% bracket that uses cash. In other words, you're about 2.5 times more likely to be using cash, and that's why you've got $60 billion to send back to Mexico to support your family there. Just another little interesting statistic that deals with this thing called cash. Now, I'm on a cash basis. I don't use credit. I only use cash. Why in the hell would I need credit if I got money? People with money don't need credit, do they? Think about that for a minute. If you had money, why would you need credit? But if you've got credit and you're making payments, then you're paying interest. And if you're paying interest, interest is the penalty that you pay for using credit. And it's obvious that you're unable to figure out how much that credit is costing you, how much that interest costs. It compounds. It compounds under what we call the rule of 72. Now, what lends urgency to this task is the disturbing evidence from the very America we tend to idolize uncritically, partly owing to the insidious propaganda of the Western media, and partly because fantasizing about an unblemished world numbs the heartbreaking realities of our society. Associating affluent America with social pathologies appears totally counterintuitive. Yet, as John DeGraff and his co-authors clearly point out in their acclaimed book, there is no denying that the American dream has gone sour for millions of Americans. And despite its trite sayings such as freedom, land of opportunity, free trade, and democracy, let's underline those. They talk about freedom, land of opportunity, free trade, democracy. My God, the president, isn't he always talking about that? Freedom, land of opportunity, free trade, and democracy. The juggernaut of capitalism has not only pauperized, but also infected them with what the authors describe as affluenza. Affluenza, according to the authors, is a painful, contagious, socially transmitted condition of overload, debt, anxiety, and waste resulting from the dogged pursuit of more. This metaphor of a disease is an opposite characterization of a malignant condition that is eating into the entrails of America. Americans' insatiable urge to acquire things, whether or not they're necessary, has indeed reached epidemic proportions. It has caused severe social and cultural dislocations, and it has warped the basic values of American society. Well, I can testify to that. Boys and girls, America isn't the same today as it was in 1950 when I was a kid, and it wasn't the same in 1950 as it was in 1900 when my granddad was a kid. Now, there's been a metamorphosis over the past 100 years, and we Americans now have become the affluent society. And in the process, we have spent ourselves into bankruptcy. Boy, is there going to be a hangover when this party comes to an end. Now, if you want to suffer from the hangover, you know, get after it. Don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But I always counsel my students right up front, especially my business students. You need to get out of debt, son, and you need to get out of debt just as soon as possible. Now, I can take a student who's in debt, $100,000, $200,000, $300,000. You know, a guy that hasn't got a prayer, not got a hope of paying that debt off. Well, not in his lifetime. You know, not in any reasonable or intelligent period of time. I can take a debt like that, and I can take you out of debt in 90 days. Do you want to go from $1 million in debt to free and clear in 90 days? $300,000 in debt, free and clear in 90 days? That's what I teach in my business school. Not only can I take you out of debt, I can take you out of debt without even paying it off, without even filing bankruptcy. You know, the average guy, he doesn't know about that. He hasn't got a clue. He doesn't know. He can't figure that out. He hasn't been to law school, but he's been propagandized. He's got a pocket full of credit cards. He's got an MBA. He's got a degree after his name. He's out here working for some big corporation, buried in his school debt, school loans, buried in credit card debt. Never be able to pay it off. I've had guys come in here, how much do you owe? $300,000? Sometimes it's to the IRS. I've had guys in here with $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 IRS debts, for crying out loud. There's no way in your lifetime that you're ever going to pay that debt off. Even as a doctor, for crying out loud, you're not going to pay that debt off. So tuck it away in your heart. This is the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and we run a school here called the Gordon Law School. We have a business school here. Tuck it away in your heart. Hey, I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you here back here tomorrow night talking about the same thing called debt. Let me remind you, though, that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, our time's about up. We're going to have to leave it right there. So let me remind you that we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.